You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, happy holidays. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're on the beach in Santa Monica facing the ocean. Look to your right and you can see the pier. The Ferris wheel is lit up blue today. It's early morning and the roller coaster carts are parked and they're waiting for their first riders.
The waves are pretty calm. They're about 0 to 2 feet. It's a pretty calm sea, just very high.
Forrest Curtis with the nonprofit Heal the Bay is standing, taking pictures of the shoreline. They're poised, waiting for a big wave to crash. It's 7 in the morning, and scientists and volunteers from San Diego all the way up to the Oregon border are standing all along the shore, taking hundreds of photos to document the king tide. That's the unofficial term for the highest that the tide ever gets.
I've seen it get up to like 3 or 4 feet, but I've rarely seen it above 4 feet. And I go out to the beach a lot for different aspects of my work.
Today, the tide is above 7 feet. Now, these exceptionally high tides are important to record because as sea levels rise, they're becoming much more common, and places that only flood during king tides now might not be habitable in 100 years. KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
About a week before the king tide, I visited this beach, sat on the sand maybe 30 feet in front of the lifeguard tower, and watched the water lap at the pier's wooden posts underneath the Ferris wheel. When the king tide came in, it was crashing well past the Ferris wheel, threatening to touch the ramp of the lifeguard tower that I sat in front of a week before. I asked Curtis if they were surprised.
Wow, yes. Absolutely.
Where does it normally come to?
Even just like behind the Ferris wheel is generally, it's gone up quite a bit, but actually in height, it's probably.
Here's how king tides work. High tides come around twice a day, and they're especially high when the sun and the moon are aligned. That happens twice per month, when the moon is new, and again when it's full. But a king tide isn't just any high tide.
We have an elliptical orbit around the sun, and sometimes we're closer to the sun than other times. And in the northern hemisphere, because of the tilt of the earth, that's in the wintertime.
So once per year, usually December or January, we're closest to the sun, and the sun's gravitational pull is stronger on us.
And then in addition to that, our moon has an elliptical, not quite round orbit. And there are times when it's also closer. And so we are experiencing a time where both the moon and the sun are simultaneously the closest they could be to the Earth inside their relative orbits.
The king tides indicate how high the ocean will get as the climate gets warmer and sea levels rise.
The king tides are what the ocean's average will look like later with sea level rise.
The beaches in Santa Monica are flat and shallow, and it's just not that big a deal if the water is crashing closer to the Ferris wheel. But take a short drive, 30 miles up the coast.
Here we go, it's coming up.
And suddenly, the threat is much more real.
That was a big one.
This is Malibu.
We just had a wave come right up to the steps here. So if this were a higher swell, we'd be wet right now, and we'd be on the other side of this. And you can see there's a whole set of stairs that we're not seeing in this area.
Dr. Michael Quill is the Marine Programs Director for the nonprofit LA Waterkeeper. He's taking pictures of the king tide in Malibu. He's standing at the top of a staircase that leads to the ironically named Broad Beach. The beach is disappearing. Most of the staircase is buried in sand since the tide is getting closer. What's left is wet with ocean spray.
I think there are another 10 stairs below the sand right here that are now, that's the high water line.
Now instead of lifeguard towers, the tide is creeping onto private property.
So the house there, if you're interested, I believe it's on the market for $100 million.
Bad news, the owner actually pulled it off the market earlier this year when it didn't sell. The owner, by the way, James Bond.
Pierce Brosnan, I think, put it on the market for $100 million. Now, you might be able to get like 50, 60 bucks off if you let them know you work with KCRW. Okay. Just kind of.
Okay, but in 50 years, can I not live there?
That's right. Like, I don't know how long it'll be there.
Since the late 1800s, the sea level already has risen globally about 9 inches. If we do a great job curbing our greenhouse gas emissions and keep global temperature rise to the 1.5 degrees Celsius that everyone agreed to at the recent UN conference in Glasgow, then sea levels will rise another 10 inches. If we do a bad job and don't curb our emissions, it could be another 8 feet in a worst-case scenario.
From where the rocks are to this property, it's just dwindling away, dwindling away, dwindling away. The high tide line goes right up to the people's property line. I'd be kind of concerned if I'm sitting there in that house and the water's going under three-quarters of my house. I mean, it's just a matter of time.
So that's why volunteers are taking pictures of the king tides now.
And I'm going to collect data, and what I'll do is I'll take a photo.
And sending them off to the California Coastal Commission.
The GPS coordinates of where I was and the time of day of the high tide that I'm shooting.
So then environmental scientists who specialize in sea level rise for the Coastal Commission can figure out what to do next. That's Carrie Batha's job.
We can use things like king tide photos to ground truth those models and help refine them. Because there's nothing like getting real evidence from the ground to show you, you know, where the water is going to go.
She says evidence has revealed that it's not just a problem for coastal residents.
Kind of an evil twin of sea level rise is that the coastal groundwater table will also rise as sea levels rise.
Recent research out of UC Berkeley found that 145,000 California residents live near a hazardous facility that's at risk of flooding by 2100. Think power plants, oil refineries, industrial facilities. LA and Orange counties have some of the highest number of sites in the state. Long Beach is full of them, places like the port and the landfills and the Wilmington refinery.
And when you think about things like industrial sites, there might be pollutants buried in the soil that haven't been exposed to water for a really long time. And when groundwater rises, those pollutants could be mobilized.
And disadvantaged communities are 6 times more likely to live near those facilities at risk of flooding. But Batha says there's good news, too. This year, California allocated more money than ever toward combating the effects of climate change.
Sea level rise is making us face kind of unprecedented challenges. But I think that when it comes down to it, we all love our shoreline and we want it to continue to be safe and resilient.
Back on the beach in Santa Monica, the king tide is over. The little window into our future only lasts about an hour. But hundreds of photos are on their way to environmental scientists to help us mitigate how much the water rises and plan for a future when it inevitably does. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
By the way, if you want to see photos of the king tide, including a park bench underwater in Seal Beach taken by Coastal Commission volunteers during the king tide, well, that link is at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. So high tides coupled with sea level rise are threatening the coastline. And as you just heard, there's another way those tides might threaten the coast and the people who live nearby. Researchers at UCLA and UC Berkeley have created a series of maps for a research project dubbed Toxic Tides. And their maps identify more than 400 sites along California's coastline that are in danger of flooding this century. And if they do, releasing all kinds of toxic stuff, industrial chemicals, military toxins, nuclear waste. What's more, many of those sites are located in and around predominantly black and brown communities. Laura Cushing is an assistant professor of environmental health sciences at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, one of the lead researchers of the Toxic Tides Project. Laura, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to join you.
What kind of research did you set out to do when you put all this in play?
Well, you know, environmental justice advocates across the state have really highlighted the fact that low-income communities, communities of color, are likely to be impacted first and worst from climate change. And that environmental justice concerns, you know, really need to be front and center as we start to have more and more conversations about kind of climate resilience planning. And more conversations like this are happening. Cities, you know, and agencies adopting climate adaptation plans, for example. But when the issue of sea level rise is looked at, typically what gets highlighted is kind of the loss of our, you know, some of our iconic beaches and other beautiful places along the coast. But of course, California's coastline is also heavily industrialized in a lot of places. And so what we set out to do with this project was really to shine a spotlight on that issue and the fact that as the seas rise, we are going to experience more risk of flooding at places that store or use hazardous substances that could potentially, you know, get released during a flood event and expose nearby communities.
When you think of California's coast, you think of like Big Sur, right? Or Monterey or San Diego, you know, I mean, very nice places, right? With where the coast is, you know, rocky, or you've got a city nearby and all of that. But you know, there are many other sites all along the coast, as you mentioned, that are industrialized. What are some of them, and what are the dangers if flooding does occur?
Yeah, well, in the LA area, you know, one of the places that really lit up on our maps was around Wilmington and Long Beach, where you've got a lot of industry, petrochemical industry right there on the coastline at low elevation. And so we did find, as you mentioned, statewide, at least 440 potentially hazardous sites that are going to experience or likely to experience increased flood risk. So, you know, Wilmington, Long Beach, that was one of the areas, but also down in San Diego, the San Francisco Bay Area has a long legacy of kind of industrial and military development along the bay that is very vulnerable to sea level rise. So those are some of the places that popped up. Oxnard was another one.
Why Oxnard? Are we talking military bases too that are nearby? That's what you were mentioning, right?
Yeah, we looked at military bases. You know, Oxnard has several power plants, which is another thing that we looked at near the coastline, oil and gas drilling, and also kind of legacy contamination sites. So places like Superfund sites where there's hazardous substances that need to be cleaned up. And in some cases, you know, there's been some remediation, but the approach has been to kind of leave the contamination there and just pave over it, if you will. And with rising seas, that really may not be adequate to protect against potential releases of these hazardous substances.
And that's what we're talking about here. When the water gets high and it can release that waste, whatever it may be. And I'm thinking, you know, we talk about Diablo Canyon, which is the nuclear power station right near San Luis Obispo. Nuclear power doesn't produce any harmful carbon emissions, so it's good, obviously, on the climate change front. It's clean energy, as it were. But all that nuclear waste is there. And I think of 2011 and Fukushima in Japan after the tsunami, and there was a flood there, and it just decimated that plant and caused all kinds of problems, right?
Yeah, so Fukushima is definitely, you know, one of these events. We call them natural technological disasters or NATEC disasters. Another that comes to mind is Hurricane Katrina or Hurricane Harvey, where, you know, you had these catastrophic flood events in an area with a lot of petrochemical industries and saw a lot of spills. So these are, of course, kind of like, you know, poster child catastrophic sudden events. And we think of sea level rise as sort of like a slow moving storm, a slow moving version of this, if you will, where, you know, it might not happen all at once, but if we don't start thinking about it and planning for it, we could very well face more and more of these kind of natural technological disasters and contaminant releases because of sea level rise.
And as you mentioned at the outset, you know, from an environmental justice standpoint, a lot of these places are, you know, lower income areas, people, more vulnerable populations, and black and brown people who are, you know, near some of the most industrialized areas in the state, correct?
That's right. So one of the things we did, in addition to, you know, trying to identify and locate potentially hazardous sites and estimate flood risk, in addition to that, we wanted to look at, you know, who lives nearby. And several community-based organizations that work on environmental justice were partners in this research. And so they helped us think about, you know, what are some of the key social vulnerability metrics we might want to look at. And we found that, you know, statewide disadvantaged communities were over 6 times more likely to live within a kilometer of one of these at-risk facilities by the end of the century. So the risks here are not equally distributed across the population, and low-income communities, communities of color, are, as I said, you know, likely to be impacted first and worst by sea level rise.
Your project, Lara, is based on the idea that more than 3 feet of sea level rise is expected by the end of this century, by the year 2100. But that's only if little is done to slow the effects of climate change. Is there, do you think, a way to reverse this? Or to avoid it from happening or to at least mitigate it?
If we don't start to drastically cut our greenhouse gas emissions worldwide, we are looking at least 3 feet of sea level rise in California by the end of the century. That's likely. Of course, there's some uncertainty involved there with projecting into the future. I'll just add that, you know, we did want to kind of show a realistic scenario, kind of like this is what you could expect if we don't change course. But we also wanted to highlight what we could avoid if we did change course. So we also modeled flood risk under a scenario where we drastically cut our greenhouse gas emissions and show what could be avoided in terms of the number of at-risk sites that we might expect by the end of the century if we took that more proactive course.
Lara Cushing, Assistant Professor of Environmental Health Sciences over at UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health, one of the researchers behind the Toxic Tides Project. Lara, thanks.
It's been a pleasure, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For decades, up until last year, the holidays for a lot of folks meant cramming into a tiny aircraft and trying to make nice, or at least make quiet.
Look, I don't want to be rude, but I'm not much of a conversationalist, and I'd really like to finish this article. A friend of mine wrote it, so...
Don't let me stand in your way. Please don't let me stand in your way. The last thing I want to be remembered as is an annoying blabbermouth. You know, nothing grinds my gears worse than some chowderhead who doesn't know when to keep his big trap shut. You catch me running off of the mouth, just give me a poke in the chops.
Just give me a poke in the chops. That's from the unforgettable John Hughes movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and of course, the late, great John Candy. Now, we have all had a Del Griffith shower curtain ring salesman seated next to us on an aircraft at some point. I know I have. But what we haven't had for decades, up until 2020, was a pandemic. And COVID-19 has brought all kinds of challenges to bear on the aircraft. Our science, tech, and car guy, Todd Mesereau, is here to help you navigate your flight efficiently and, yes, safely. Hey, Todd.
Hello, Steve.
Are you going anywhere on a jet plane this holiday?
Thankfully, Steve, the only place I'm going is the grocery store. I'm staying put here in Los Angeles. What about you?
You know, that's dangerous enough, as a matter of fact. I am visiting family out east, which means I'm going to be spending several hours in an airport and then in a sealed aluminum tube with a couple hundred mostly strangers. So, of course, with Omicron happening, a lot of people are wondering how safe that is. But the airlines have really talked this up, that inside the cabin, it's clean air, 99.9% clean air, which sounds pretty safe, right?
Well, that is exactly what they say. Boeing's one of the two main airplane manufacturers, you know, the 747, 737, 787, among others. They claim that number. A representative from Boeing said in an email response to me, Boeing airplanes use high-efficiency particulate air, HEPA, filters that remove more than 99.9% of particulates, such as bacteria and viruses, from the air before it is recirculated to the cabin.
So I am reassured by that, right? Or at least I should be?
Well, maybe. I talked with William J. McGee, who's an aviation journalist and passenger advocate. He was an airline operations manager. He's the author of a book, Attention All Passengers, that has things in it he thinks we should all know about the airline industry. He's not 100% sold on the 99.9% and the HEPA filters.
You know, if I'm sitting right next to you, and one of us sneezes or coughs or takes off a mask to talk, those little particulates are not going to get up to the filter and back down. They're going to go direct.
Well, you're not supposed to take the mask off unless you're eating, right? But we'll get to that in just a minute. What about the Federal Aviation Administration, which oversees the airline industry? I mean, it must have regulations about clean air inside airplanes.
Well, there are regulations, you're right. But when I asked the FAA about cabin air quality and regulations, here's what Ian Greger, public affairs specialist, wrote me in an email. He said, quote, FAA regulations specify strict cabin air standards, but do not require testing, unquote.
Wait, so you have the standards, but there's no accountability to that? Is that right?
That's exactly right. Zero. And it's not just a matter of zero enforcement. There's no requirement for any data to be gathered, despite the fact that the FAA does indeed have strict standards. I also talked with Tristan Lorraine. He's a former British Airways captain turned documentary filmmaker.
I can fly along in this airplane and I can tell you the temperature outside. I can tell you the temperature of the fuel. I can even tell you the temperature in the passenger cabin, but I can't actually tell you what the air quality of the air you're breathing is. Every house has a smoke detector. Many houses have carbon monoxide detectors. A small propeller airplane will have a carbon monoxide detector, but a $100 million jet doesn't have any way of knowing what the quality of the air people are breathing in.
It definitely, Todd, seems like the FAA needs some teeth. Airplanes obviously need some sensors, but here's the thing. I don't recall reading or telling any stories about any super spreader flights. So something must be going right with the airlines, right? Especially with so many people traveling. We had 20 million people traveling over Thanksgiving, right? Just about a month ago.
That's the right point to consider. And especially since Thanksgiving's travel numbers weren't that far off 2019's numbers before the pandemic. So there were a lot of people in the sky. I asked Dr. Jeffrey Klausner, who's a clinical professor of preventative medicine at USC's Keck School of Medicine, about that exact point.
I work for a company called Curative Testing Company, and we routinely ask people, you know, about their recent exposures. Have they been to family gatherings? Have they been to restaurants? Have they been to work? What kind of work do they do? Have they been on airline travel? And when we look at and compare, you know, the frequency of these different exposures among people who test positive and test negative, recent airline travel does not, pop up.
Well, that's great to hear, Todd. I mean, I'm feeling better about my upcoming flight, right? What else do I need to know?
Well, I asked your friend, Professor Paula Cannon, a virologist at USC, the most important thing to do to fly safely this holiday season, especially with Omicron.
We now know that Omicron kind of laughs at vaccinated people unless they've been boosted. It's quite a clever virus. So what I'm going to say is the number one thing to do by far is to be boosted, is to be vaccinated and boosted, and everything else kind of pales into insignificance compared to that thing you can do.
All right, that's great, actually. What else does she advise?
What I do say to people is, you know, if you sit on the plane, first of all, take a sweater with you, and then secondly, turn on the air vent above your head, because that is going to be blowing air away from you. And again, if there's somebody next to you with you know, COVID, it's also going to be blowing that air away as well. So I think that's a good strategy, although it can probably make you pretty cold on a long journey.
What about the mask, Todd? Should I wear a specific kind of mask, an N95, a KN95?
Well, Professor Cannon wears a KN95, but here's her real-world thinking about it.
You shouldn't let perfect be the enemy of good. All masks are good. Some masks are better. And it's better to wear a mask that you find comfortable and can wear for the entire journey than to be sort of messing around with and fiddling with a mask that you find deeply uncomfortable.
Ooh, I'm feeling better actually about flying. I've already flown a couple of times this year, Todd. So, and knock wood, I was okay.
Awesome.
And millions of people are okay flying,
yes.
and you know, vis-a-vis COVID. So let's knock wood and hope everyone has a happy holiday, including yourself, Todd Mesereau, Greater LA's science tech and car guy. Todd, thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great and safe trip.
That's all the time we have for this evening. Tomorrow, you've probably been hearing about an increase in crime in LA, but what are the real numbers? How are they being used politically? That's tomorrow with a new episode of Greater LA. Tell us how you're doing, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA and subscribe to the podcast. And while you're at the website, why not support the radio station and podcast that supports you back? It's KCRW's Season of Giving Back, asking for your help to keep us healthy and sound through the holidays and into next year. If regular episodes of GLA help you get through the day or help put your world into context, then why not take a minute to go online and make a tax-deductible contribution at kcrw.com/give. We sure would appreciate it. And today only, when you support KCRW, you'll be entered for a chance to win Apple's latest and most sophisticated digital device, the iPhone 13. Donate or join at any level to be automatically entered to win through midnight tonight, the iPhone 13. Go to kcrw.com/give, and good luck. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sudley, Crystal Goss, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help put this evening's show together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.